The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Cancer is still the second leading cause of death in the United States. With decades of concerted research, development, and clinical trials, the medical community has finally started to move the needle with regard to certain cancer-specific diagnoses, with significant gains in chronic myelogenous leukemia and melanoma, just to name a couple. We hear more and more about cancer immunotherapy as we see shockingly expensive new medications advertised on television and written about in the media with six-figure price tags. How do we make sense of all of this at an individual level when the dreaded C-word enters the lives of you or your loved ones? Fortunately, a new book called Taking Charge of Cancer provides a helpful roadmap to guide you through cancer, from diagnosis to staging to treatment options and aftercare. Written in clear language, Taking Charge of Cancer is the type of book I'd recommend to patients or family members dealing with a cancer diagnosis. It's the best handbook I've seen that gives an overall perspective, not just for disease-specific conditions. Its author, Dr. David Palma, is a radiation oncologist and researcher at the London Health Science Center in Ontario, Canada, where he is also an associate professor at Western University. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. David Palma, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start just by asking you what motivated you to write the book.
Sure. Thanks, John. A couple of years ago, my best friend was diagnosed with colon cancer. He and I had gone to high school together, and our kids play together. Our wives are best friends. And so when he was diagnosed, he turned to me for some help. And it's the kind of cancer that I didn't treat. So the two of us together took a series of steps to make sure that he was getting good quality care, because there really were no books out there that focuses on making sure that you get the best care. And after we did this, the two of us, he realized that patients really need a handbook to be able to do this themselves, because not everyone can have an oncologist as their friend. And that's where the book came from.
So you make a point about one thing that I really liked hearing, because I see this a lot of times, both in medical practice and in, I think, health journalism, which is we tend to think of cancer as sort of a monolithic disease. We talk about the war on cancer. We talk about, you know, stand up to cancer, all kinds of obviously worthy advocacy groups and charities to, you know, help in the research and fighting of cancer. But cancer really isn't one disease. It's myriad diseases. And as a radiation oncologist, you practice, you know, you see a lot of different cancer in many different forms. I mean, so how did you describe that in the book?
Well, you're right. People have this conception that cancer is just one thing, but it really is thousands of different diseases. And I tell patients that if you were to look at cancer in one patient, that's maybe a lung cancer, and a cancer in another patient, that's also a lung cancer. If you were to look at the genes in those cancers, the genes that drive it to grow, they'll be different. And the abnormalities in the cancer will be different, and each one will behave differently. And so within the category of lung cancer, we already know that there are several different types of lung cancer that all behave differently. But the crazy thing is that if you take one patient's tumor, only in one patient, and you look at different parts of the cancer within that tumor, the little different cells, each of those might behave differently. So you sometimes hear a lot about, why haven't we made any progress against cancer? Well, we haven't made progress against all kinds of cancer, but we've made progress against most. And the reason why things take so long is that each cancer is a puzzle. It's a nut that we have to crack. And each one is very, very difficult. And it takes time to get solutions for each of these different types of cancers.
So one of the very important recommendations you make at the outset is about the initial consultation, or where it all starts. You call it your first consultation. Mm-hmm. And you make a couple of recommendations I thought were interesting. One that I think is pretty well accepted these days, bring a sidekick. You know, have someone who, because let's face it, if you're hearing about cancer and maybe what your options are going to be, we know from medical literature that oftentimes all patients hear is cancer. They're not really hearing a lot about the options. So having a loved one or family member or a friend who can advocate, ask questions, and write things down is obviously critically important. But you also had a suggestion which I think is probably relatively new to most folks, which is recording the consultation. Do you have folks who do that with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say at least once a week, but even more commonly than that. And the problem is that there's so much information being given. And like you said, John, people are shell-shocked once they hear the diagnosis of cancer, that everything after that can be forgotten. And I think doctors make it a bit worse, because sometimes we're not very direct in how we say things. We might beat around the bush, or sometimes we use medical lingo when we shouldn't. But the nice thing about recording the conversation is then later on you can go home and you can listen to it again, and you can pick up on the things that you've missed. But also your family members who weren't there can also listen in to get their own understanding of what's going on. Most doctors now are keen to have that. It helps patients understand. And so just ask your doctor, if you're a cancer patient, can I record this? And almost always they'll say yes. And then usually with your smartphone nowadays, off you go.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think, I mean, I just, as a doctor, reacted to that when I was reading. I was like, ooh, I wouldn't want people to record it. But then again, then thinking about it with kind of my patient hat on, thought, absolutely, what a great idea. And I mean, in primary care, I don't have patients do that, but I might want to start suggesting that. I mean, I think it might make the HIPAA folks very nervous or whatever if the phone gets lost or something like that.
Yeah, and as long as they've consented and they agree to put it on their phone, then you shouldn't run into troubles with privacy. But I agree, as a doctor, it makes you think a little bit more about what you're saying. It makes you make sure that you're trying to be as accurate as possible. So it doesn't put a bit more onus on the doctor. But in the end, it's a pretty minor concern.
So what else do you recommend in the first consultation? It's mostly, I think, a set of what to expect. But what kinds of things would you summarize here as for what folks to expect at their first consultation?
I think so. The consultation can be thought of as a first visit where the doctor is trying to get information from you and then give you information about the different options. And at the end of the consultation, you might be given your treatment options or you might be told that there are more tests to be done. But I think another simple thing that patients can do at the time of their consultation is ask their doctor for copies of their tests and of their biopsy if they've had one. So if you've had a CAT scan, for example, or a PET scan, you can ask your doctor for a report. And there are tools in the book and also in the associated website. There's some free videos that help you to understand your own medical records because everything depends on those scans. And as you know, as a physician, it's very easy to overlook something. You might get a scan of your lungs and it notices something at the top of your liver that needs another scan, but the doctor might not read the whole report or might dismiss it. But as a patient, you can go back and say, wait a second, there's something else that needs to be looked at. And when you hear in the news, you hear these horror stories in the news. There was a doctor in Detroit or in Michigan somewhere that was sentenced to 45 years in jail for giving patients chemo when they didn't need it. Here in Canada, there was a doctor who did surgery on women with breast cancer who didn't need the surgery. Same thing happened actually in England. A surgeon was just sentenced to jail for the same thing. And if patients had copies of their reports, copies of the biopsy that said this is cancer or this isn't cancer, some of these big errors could be avoided. So the new thing about the book that no other book really tells you that I've seen is to get a copy of your reports and go through those to understand them.
So you give examples in the book pretty well of trying to help people decipher, you know, what the difference between, say, a PET scan or a CT scan, a CAT scan, as we sometimes call it, mm-hmm. or what a bone scan is, for example, which is a nuclear medicine test where I'm looking at the page right now, which is sort of your whole skeleton, and it just shows where things kind of light up using this nuclear tracer to suggest areas of, it's not really specific, it can be cancer or it can be actually inflammation. But what's the best way for people to get their information or get their medical information? Because that's often seen as a great barrier.
Yeah, there can be some official ways to do it, and there can be some shortcuts to do it. You know, the official way would be when you're at the hospital or your cancer center, you go to the medical records area, and there's usually a form to fill out and maybe a fee, and it's regulated by law across the U.S. how much can be charged, and they'll give you copies of your reports. But you don't need everything in your medical chart. You just need the specific things related to your cancer, like your consultation report and some of your scans. But there are also some ways around it. Some cancer centers have an online portal where you can go for free and get the results of your test. But there are a few little tricks. One is that if you're going to have a scan done, when you go to check in at the scanner and they're asking you for your information, say, hey, can you send a copy of the report to me in the mail as the patient? And many of them will say yes. Or the other thing you can do is when you're visiting with your doctor, you can say, hey, you know, the doctor is going to give you the report, or they're going to tell you the report. They're going to say, oh, your CT scan is clear, or your CT scan shows this. You can say, hey, you know, I'm keeping my medical records. Can you just print off a copy for me? And those ways are ways that you can often get the reports without having to go through the official medical records. And that can also save you some money sometimes.
I like that. And David Palma, I wanted to ask you about a chapter titled, Is Your Doctor's Recommendation Best for You? I thought this was pretty interesting because you talk about how reasonable doctors might disagree about specific recommendations for cancer treatment, and you list scientific reasons because, you know, different doctors can certainly interpret the medical literature a different way. But then you also have a section about the influence of bias. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, doctors are supposed to always have their patients' best interests at heart, but unfortunately, we can be influenced, and sometimes we don't even realize we're being influenced, but we can be influenced by other factors. And one of them is the bias of your own specialty. And what that means is that as a surgeon, you're more likely to favor surgery as the treatment choice for a certain kind of cancer. And as a radiation doctor like me, I'm more likely to recommend radiation. Doctors have a sense of pride in their own specialty. They've trained in that. They see themselves as that specialist. And so they often feel that that's the best treatment. But often there can be a financial incentive as well, and that by treating patients, your income could go higher. And the other influence that's important to keep in mind is industry influence. If there are pharmaceutical companies involved, that can be a powerful motivator in terms of physician behavior. So how is the patient to know? How do you know if your doctor is being biased? An easy way to do that is to ask for an opinion from what's called a multidisciplinary team. So a multidisciplinary team, it means that you have a surgeon or a radiation doctor who are working together. And so many cancer centers, if you're going with a diagnosis of lung cancer or breast cancer or prostate cancer, you can go and be seen by a multidisciplinary team that would all at once visit you, or you would visit them, I guess. There'd be a surgeon, a radiation doctor, sometimes a chemotherapy doctor as well. And that can reduce the risk of the bias, because it's hard to be biased when you have your peers around who have opinions from the other specialties. But there's actually another thing that you can do that doesn't involve much work, and it's a way of getting a free second opinion. Patients can ask for their case to be discussed at something called a tumor board. And what a tumor board is, it's a meeting. Most centers have them once a week, and it's a meeting of specialists of a certain type of cancer. So you'll have a tumor board for lung cancer, and a tumor board for breast cancer, and a tumor board for prostate cancer. And at the prostate cancer tumor board, you have all different types of prostate cancer experts. And at the tumor board, they'll discuss patient cases, and they will review the images and review the tests, and then all the doctors in the room will provide an opinion. And so what you can ask your doctor is, hey, can you present my case at a multidisciplinary tumor board? And if they have one at the center, and many centers do, especially the biggest academic centers, then they'll bring your case there, and they'll come back with a recommendation. And that can give you a different treatment option, and also it can reassure you that the recommendation that you're getting is free of bias because you have all the specialties involved.
You also have in here about getting other second opinions a decision aid. What do you mean by decision aids?
So decisions are hard in life. You know, you're trying to decide on a new car or a new purchase of some kind. It's very hard to make decisions. And in medicine, it can be even harder because the decisions can have lifelong consequences. But it's hard to be fully informed, and it's hard, like we said at the beginning, to really understand everything that your doctor is telling you. So a decision aid is an online tool that a patient can use to help them make a decision in a specific scenario. One common scenario is prostate cancer, where many men with prostate cancer, a slow-growing prostate cancer, can choose. They can choose between having surgery, they can have radiation, either internal radiation or external radiation, or they can be observed with treatment deferred until it's needed later. And so an online decision aid, what it does is it takes you through each of those options. First, it'll ask you your preferences. So for the prostate cancer patient, one patient might prefer to preserve things like their sexual function, or they're really concerned about incontinence, whereas another patient might be really, really scared about the cancer, not so concerned about side effects. So first, the decision aid takes into account your own preferences and then gives you information about how each of the different treatment options fit with that to help you to make a decision. And patients find them quite effective in helping them to consolidate the information and then make a decision that takes into account their own preferences.
Excellent. And you have also in this book, Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment, a chapter when you're looking specifically at surgical treatment for cancer. And you reiterate something that we have heard in the lay press and something that we do see in some of the articles on quality improvement in healthcare and better outcomes in healthcare, which is in surgery, it does appear that volume makes all the difference. And by that, I mean, what is your surgeon's experience level? What did you find in doing your research for the book?
Volumes are very important, and it runs across almost all different types of cancer. So what this means, it's almost like the term practice makes perfect, meaning the more you do something, the better you get at it. The more you do it with a focus on quality improvement. So what we see across the U.S., across Canada, for many different types of cancer, is that hospitals that do it more commonly have much better outcomes than hospitals that do it only rarely. And this is most important for high-risk surgeries. So let's take the example of pancreatic cancer. So pancreatic cancer is a very lethal cancer. So some patients with pancreatic cancer can be cured, but to be cured, you have to have the cancer removed. In the U.S., if you go to a high-volume center where they do this pancreas surgery all the time, the chance of dying of a complication from that surgery is about 3 or 4%. And that's a modest risk. It's higher than we would like, but it's a chance that we take in order to have a chance of cure. But if you were to go and have your surgery at a low-volume center, meaning they don't do it very often, your chance of dying from that surgery is not 3 or 4%. It's 16%. It's four times as high, a huge difference. But patients have been mostly unaware of this. For other cancers where it's not as risky, let's say a breast cancer surgery, the impact is not as severe, but it still is there. And so patients can ask their doctors, are you a high-volume surgeon, and is this a high-volume center? And if it is, then you're reassured. If it's not, it should get into a discussion of the importance of that and whether a referral to a high-volume center is warranted.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out, those are sometimes difficult conversations for patients to have, but at least your book really gives people the knowledge they may need to empower them to really, you know, because knowledge is power, to have that kind of difficult conversation. And any doctor should be willing to answer that question openly and honestly. I want to turn, David, to your own specialty, which you admit in the book is a little bit of a mystery, radiation oncology.
Yeah.
And I would say as someone who's gone through a medical education, you know, and maybe just done a few days of a rotation in radiation oncology, it fortunately for me has been, remains somewhat of a black box. And you asked this question fairly straightforward, which I thought was pretty funny, whether it's photon or proton. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, and it sounds like it's very, very, you know, esoteric stuff. But there are different machines that give radiation. Most machines use what are called photons. And photons, it just means it's a form of energy, just like light. So light is photons. So just think of photons as being light, or X-rays. X-rays are also photons. So these machines give you X-rays. So you go and have a tumor treated with X-rays. And X-rays have been around to treat cancer for a long, long time, since the 1920s. But there are these machines out there that give a different kind of radiation called protons. What a proton is just a small part of the atom that you split apart, and you use the proton to hit the tumor. And scientifically, protons have some hype to them. They seem to have the potential to do a bit better, but that hasn't yet been proven. And the cost of them is enormous, the cost for the patients or the cost to Medicare. In some cases, Medicare will reimburse for them. In some cases, they won't. But what we're faced with in my specialty as radiation doctors is we have centers across the world, but it's a lot across the U.S. where they'll say, hey, look at me, we have this great new machine that delivers protons, or we have this great new machine that delivers something different, or we have this kind of machine with this cool name that usually has knife in it. You know, some of the products include CyberKnife and Gamma Knife. They all sound very, very cool. But the thing that I tell patients is that in most cases, it doesn't actually matter what kind of machine you're on. As long as you're on a modern machine, it doesn't really matter, and the proof that it does matter is not there. So a lot of this hype can lead to extra costs for patients that are not really necessary. We see the same thing with robotic surgery in the U.S. There are all these centers that say, oh, you know, we have this robot, come in and have your surgery done by the robot. But the studies to show that the robot is better have not panned out. And so I just give patients the freedom to ask that question. Do I really need this super expensive machine, especially if you're paying out of pocket or if you have a lifetime, you know, limit to how much insurance you have? Do I really need the most expensive machine? Because in many cases, you probably don't.
I guess one last question about that is, Canada having a form of universal health coverage, how would you classify the differences in proton beam therapy between the U.S. and Canada? I mean, I assume that they're much more prevalent in the U.S. where there's sort of more of a free market mentality.
Yeah, there is, absolutely. And so in Canada, we've taken more of an approach where we wait for the evidence to come out, or we generate the evidence before it's brought in. But sometimes we can lag behind. So when new drugs or new machines are coming into the U.S., we can sometimes be a bit slower at getting those because things go through the government. So Canada has yet to build a proton machine like the ones that are all over the U.S. But once the evidence is there, then the impetus will come. And right now, finally, across the U.S., some of the big proton trials are being done, but it's going to be a bit of time before we have those results. And even one of the biggest ones, they did a lung cancer trial where they give half the patients protons, half the patients the older radiation, and it didn't actually make a difference in terms of outcomes, which makes you think, really, do we need to be spending $200 million on a proton machine when a standard radiation machine only costs 1% of that, or maybe 2% of that. So in Canada, we have this good and the bad. The good is that sometimes we wait until things are proven, but the bad is that once it's proven, it can take a bit longer for it to get up to us.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is David Palma. He is an associate professor of radiation oncology at Western University and practices at the London Health Sciences Center in Ontario, Canada. And his book is called Taking Charge of Cancer. It's really a helpful handbook that if, heaven forbid, you are diagnosed, you or a loved one are diagnosed with cancer, it's a book you're going to want to have on your shelf because it's really a very clearly written, very straightforward, and relatively short, I might say, too, approach to how to approach cancer. I mean, there's many, many books out there about cancer survivorship and cancer advocacy for specific kinds of cancer. And Dr. Palma has made the point that cancer is really thousands of different diseases. So you want to at least think through systematically what that approach is and how you may hear very different things about and very different recommendations depending on where you are, what kind of treatment you're going to get. And David Palma, I wanted to ask you to describe the difference between curative and palliative, because those are words that get thrown around a lot, particularly in cancer care, and you have a nice section on that in the book.
This comes down to what the goal of the cancer treatment is. And the goal of the treatment sometimes is to cure the cancer. We call that a curative treatment. And what that means is that you'd have treatment for your cancer. So let's say for a breast cancer, you have surgery, maybe some radiation after. The goal is to get rid of the cancer. So you go on, you live your life. If you're destined to live to 100, and that's what's going to happen, that's a curative treatment. A palliative treatment means that we can't cure a cancer, but the treatments are designed to slow down the cancer, to maintain quality of life, and often to extend survival. So you could still live a couple of years extra because of the treatment, but we won't ever cure the cancer completely. This difference is extremely important, but we know from surveys of patients across the U.S. that most patients don't actually know what the goal of the treatment is, and not because of any fault on the part of the patients, but mostly because doctors are not doing a good job of getting the message across. There was a study from researchers at Harvard a couple of years ago where they asked about 1,000 patients with lung cancer and colon cancer, what is the goal of your chemotherapy? And all the patients that they asked were getting chemotherapy that was meant to be palliative, meaning there was no chance that it could cure the cancer. But when they asked these patients what the goal was, 3/4 of them thought that the goal was to cure the cancer. They were totally mistaken. And this is a huge problem on our part as physicians because it asks the question, how can people make good decisions about what treatment they want, about how they want to live their life, about planning for the future, about spending time with their family, if they don't even know what the ultimate goal is? So I always say to people, if you can take one thing from our conversation about quality of care, if you can take one thing, it is ask your doctors, what is the goal of my treatment? Is it curative or is it palliative?
You go on near that section of the book to, in folks for whom cancer is not curable, to at least give some guidance about the possibility, if you live in an area where it is possible, to enroll in a clinical trial. What are some guidelines you might recommend if someone may have that available to them, or what are some things to think about?
So a clinical trial is a way that we test a new medication before it's brought into the clinic to be used for everybody. And clinical trials are what really differentiate our form of medicine, which I would call Western medicine, or some people call it allopathic medicine, or a standard medical model, versus alternative medicine, where they just give anything and it often isn't proven or sometimes proven not to help. So we'll only use something for the most part if it's been proven to help. And the way that we prove it is with clinical trials. But the good thing about a clinical trial is that in some cases, it allows access to drugs that are in development before they're widely available. And I'll give you a great example of this. Just in the past couple of years has been the advent of a new kind of cancer treatment called immunotherapy. And immunotherapy is a drug treatment, but it's not chemotherapy. What immune therapy does is it takes the brakes off the immune system so the immune system will attack the cancer. And it's shown to have huge benefits for some kind of cancers like melanoma, lung cancer, head and neck cancer, bladder cancer. And there are hundreds of trials ongoing now with immunotherapy. But if you were to look back a few years at the first trials of immunotherapy, where nobody knew for sure that it would work, but it was helpful, the patients on those, some of those patients really, really benefited. And some, if you go on social media, will tell you that that's how they first got their immunotherapy, and they're still alive today. So by entering a clinical trial, it can give patients access. There's no guarantee, but sometimes you can have access to a drug that won't be available for many years.
You conclude the book with a section that I also really enjoyed. You call it Cancer Myths and Truths, and there's too many to go into here, but I thought I would throw a couple your way. Myth or truth, dietary changes can fight cancer?
So if you read the popular media, you would think yes. You know, you read all these articles about eating blueberries or different types of berries or vegetables. Diet can be very helpful in preventing cancer, but once you have a cancer, for the most part, diet has very, very little influence. And even though you might hear about cutting out sugar or making your diet more or less acidic or eating vegan, none of that has shown to really have any effect on whether or not a cancer grows or whether or not a cancer comes back. In some very small scenarios, like some of the cancers that are related to hormones, like breast cancer, prostate cancer, there can be a very, very small effect if you make a drastic change to your diet. But for the most part, it's just not true. And, well, you might think, oh, so what? You know, so what if people are promoting this myth? But it can have a real harm. You know, you have patients who are, let's say, at the end of life, then maybe they have 3 to 6 months of life to live, and they're told that by giving up sugar or giving up all carbohydrates, they're going to fight their cancer. So they just have this diet for the rest of their life where they're not eating anything that they enjoy. Anytime they do, they feel guilty, but they shouldn't. They feel guilty that they're fueling their cancer, and they lose weight. And when you're dealing with a cancer at the end of life, you don't want to be losing weight. You want to be maintaining your weight as much as you can. So these myths can be harmful. They're not just little innocent things that we can ignore.
I'll give you one more myth or truth because it's so prevalent. We see in the media and just, I think, in the scuttlebutt around the clinics and things that I hear. And that is, myth or truth, alternative treatments can cure cancer.
So one thing that we struggle with as doctors is getting our message out there. And we can't compete very well when there's a celebrity out there who's famous and says vitamin C can cure cancer, or even outside the cancer world, if autism is caused by a vaccine, which is not, obviously. But we have trouble competing because they have so much star power. And when you go online, you see these alternative options out there, and just because something is natural, people can have they can gravitate to it. And I understand that everybody is very valid to want to look at all your options out there. But there has been nothing alternative that has been shown to be helpful, because anything that has been shown to be helpful, we adopt it ourselves as treatment. I can give you an example of that. You know, one of the few things that you hear about that is actually true is that ginger can help in fighting nausea. It's been shown in some good trials to do so. And some people actually do try ginger to help. Not some doctors do. We take it over as part of our medical care. But the problem with alternative medicine, there are a few. One is the idea of false hope, but also it can be a moneymaker. And people can be tricked into spending money on things that aren't helpful. I have some patients who've tried, for example, IV vitamin C. So it's given about once a week, sometimes twice a week, about $300 a week to get this IV vitamin C. And it doesn't seem to matter that trials of high-dose vitamin C in humans have not shown that it fights cancer at all. But nonetheless, people are still selling it. And in some cases, they are not having their standard cancer treatment, which could have led them to a cure. And occasionally, unfortunately, we do have a patient who decides to not go with a curative treatment option and try something alternative. And in my experience, very sadly, this does often end in disaster, because a cancer is only curable before it spreads. And once it's spread, for the most part, it's not. So if you take 3 months or 6 months to try some IV vitamin C, not only are you wasting a whole bunch of money, but you might be losing the chance at a cure.
It would make for very expensive urine, is what we always used to say in medical school.
Yeah.
Nothing more than that. Well, the name of the book is Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. And it's written by my guest today, David Palma, who is a radiation oncologist at the London Health Sciences Center and also an associate professor at Western University. David Palma, thanks so much for joining us.
Excellent. Thanks so much, John.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.